For this segment of Health Styles, I'm joined by co-producer and nurse extraordinaire, Dr. Kenya Beard. Hi, Kenya. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
It's always great to be back on the air with you, Diana.
Well,
today we're going to take a closer look at health disparities.
Great.
And discuss innovative ways to improve the health of our society. A few weeks ago, last month, we aired a segment that addressed high blood pressure, also known as hypertension. And we focused on high blood pressure not just because it's the silent killer affecting one out of three Americans, but because when it comes to health disparities, we see the alarmingly disproportionate effect that high blood pressure has on blacks. For instance, blacks have a higher incidence of high blood pressure, and it affects them at a younger age. They have a higher prevalence, where we see that close to 40% of black adults have high blood pressure. And lastly, the mortality rate is much higher, and high blood pressure kills. So on the last segment with Dr. Carla Booten Foster from Weill Cornell, she had joined us to discuss her research around high blood pressure in the Harlem community. And she raised a critical concern. Stress has an important fact, plays an important factor in high blood pressure. So typically when we discuss risk reduction strategies or the management of high blood pressure, we sort of emphasize lifestyle modification. We talk about the importance of a healthy diet, exercise, and rest. But Carla alluded to a critical concern that is sometimes overlooked because it's not always easily recognized, and that's the effect that stress has on blood pressure. We know that stress definitely has a physiological effect on our body because it causes our blood vessels to constrict, and that raises our blood pressure, but it is believed to have a short-term effect on the body as well. Now, more evidence is coming into play, and it's suggesting that chronic stress could be just as significant as high cholesterol or have similar effects to smoking. But what's also disconcerting is that chronic stress could play a key part in why we continue to see disparities in health and health outcomes. So what exactly does stress look like in the black community? Joining us today to respond to this question is Dr. Willie Tolliver. He's been a social worker since 1976 and is currently on the faculty of the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College and the Social Welfare Doctoral Program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Willie has served on the faculties of Florida A&M University Social Welfare Department and the Boston University School of Social Work. His research has focused on human diversity and cultural competence and anti-oppressive and restorative practice, and we are delighted to have him on the show today. So, Dr. Tolliver, welcome to Health Styles.
Thank you so much, Kenya. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about what chronic stress looks like in the black community.
Okay. It looks like, no surprise, racism. Social injustice in the African-American community is generational. It has been experienced by family members one generation after another. People, unless they are have a way, an analysis to talk about these issues, then the way they talk about them are fall on a range from it's just the man with his foot on my neck to something more sophisticated. And the inability to talk and to analyze these issues in a way that focuses people on what they can do about these problems causes this trauma to get suppressed. And it goes into family members, younger family members, who really don't know what's going on. They just know that there's a great deal of tension at certain times in the house. Maybe it's around being able to pay rent or pay mortgage, or someone has lost a job, or more recently, We see high incarceration rates, so people disappear and they go off to prison or they go off to jail, and there really isn't a ritual for family members to grieve the loss of this person who has psychologically and emotionally disappeared. So these stressors are omnipresent. People don't get away from them, unlike the military veteran who comes home from the military theater of war and experiences post-traumatic stress disorder. These are folks who are living in a chronic situation of stress and trauma.
So this is so timely, given what's been going on both in New York and in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. It really is quite timely.
Yes, it is, Diana. It is, and it's especially in my profession, it's almost unforgivable for me that clinical practitioners have not made this association of trauma and the impact of trauma. I mean, we know what that does to people. We know that it causes people to live in a survival mode. So much of what we do in terms of psychotherapy requires a person to be in higher brain functioning. It's very difficult to do talk therapy, which is higher brain functioning, when you're in survival mode. Mm. And so many of the populations we deal with here in New York City or across the country living in urban centers are in this space where they are constantly expecting the shoe to fall or some horror to occur.
So, Willie, you said that some clinicians are not addressing this issue. Why do you think that is?
I don't think people have really made the connection of trauma and historical trauma. I don't think that's understood. I mean, I didn't start seeing this in the literature myself until there was a woman at Harvard, Bajan, I think is her name, in psychology, who started working in indigenous communities here in North America, people who are Native Americans, and she saw, for example, all of the things that you talked about in your setup, Kenya. She saw high blood pressure. She saw high rates of alcoholism, suicide, depression. She saw children being abused physically, emotionally, sexually. She also saw high rates of domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And rather than blaming the people for this, she looked to see structurally what had occurred. And, of course, not everyone knows this history, but the history of the way Native people were treated in this country is appalling. And so what she did, instead of blaming these people for the physical and medical conditions that she found them in, she worked with them to reconnect to their ritual ways of healing, to heal the trauma. Many of the folks, in fact, there's a wonderful film that we use here at the school about the Inupiat people in Alaska. And many of the folks, these Inupiat people made the film themselves, a documentary, as a way of apologizing to their children for not teaching them the language and not teaching them the rituals and traditions of their people. Mm. And what the folks in the film talk about is how they were removed from their parents and sent to boarding schools, to live in boarding schools, and how traumatic that was for them. One guy talks about how they cried in as if they were an orchestra. It sounded like an orchestra playing with all of these children crying. And clearly this was social policy embraced by the United States of America, implemented to drive out the savage in Native American people, to make them assimilate.
Yeah, it's
so how do we move forward, Willie? How do we get past the historical trauma and allow individuals and groups to heal? Because it sounds like, you know, the threat of discrimination definitely creates a state of hypervigilance.
Absolutely.
And
if
that's the case, then how do we truly achieve a state of relaxation? How do we move forward?
I don't know that we will achieve a state of relaxation. I love to read Du Bois. I enjoy going back reading the folks who came a long time before us and and to learn from them how they took on living in a world that was really not nice to them. And nice is putting it, very lovingly. But what I can see in their writing and in their actions is that African Americans have done better in this country when African Americans actually named what their concerns were and addressed those concerns through their own actions. Of course, they had to form alliances with other people to get things accomplished. And, for example, at Florida A&M University, where I taught and also was an undergraduate student, during the times of segregation in Florida, African-American people in the state of Florida raised money to build a hospital at Florida A&M University so that their nursing students could learn how to become nurses. The segregated hospitals would not permit nursing students to come in and do internships, right? So I think that there will always be struggle. At least this is what Derrick Bell says, and he's someone I have great respect for as well. You know, he was at Harvard, teaching in the law school, left there because the administrator said they could not find a woman to tenure in the law school, so he gave up his tenure position and came to NYU. He's now deceased. But one of the things that he says that I take to heart is that we must recognize that these struggles will be with us and struggle anyway. Mm-hmm. We must do the work. And I think what I see that has promise, there's one program out in Santa Ana, California. It's called Latino Health Access, founded by a woman from South America who is a public health physician. And she went into Santa Ana, saw that the 70% Spanish-speaking community had all of the things that you talked about, diabetes, the things that I talked about, intimate partner violence, alcoholism. She chose diabetes as her point of entry. She's mm-hmm. now working with people. She works with people who are living with diabetes, teaches them how to live with diabetes and to live in a way that has a quality of life that they can enjoy. And then these promotories, as they are called, these promoters, go out and find other people who are living with diabetes in the community, work with them, help them to learn about diet, how to prepare healthy foods. When I went out to visit in 2010, there were young people now in elementary schools and in middle schools who are weighing themselves, paying attention to what they eat. And all of this, I mean, you have 15-year-old kids writing articles to other adolescents to help them understand how we must take responsibility for our health care and take care of ourselves.
Okay. So what I'm hearing is that we really can no longer just sit by and allow people to suppress their trauma, and that we really need to provide ways for communities to effectively express their reality.
Absolutely.
We're listening to Health Styles on WBAI with Dr. Diana Mason and Dr. Kenya Beard. We have Dr. Willie Tolliver from the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College and the Social Welfare Doctoral Program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York joining us today. We have been discussing the effect that chronic stress has on high blood pressure, and Willie has been giving us a visual of what chronic stress looks like in the Black community, both today and historically. So, Willie, do you see the stress-related ramifications that stem from the Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner as being different from the day-to-day stressors that some communities face today?
I think that the stressors associated with Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, It's strange. In many ways, you know, I work with young people here at the school. One young man who he's actually a man of African descent. He came to this country as a child, he's not African American. He's a person from the continent, and he shared with me that he had been stopped 30 times by police officers.
Wow.
And I have talked to other students of color here in our school, and they report similar things. And then when we ask them, so what is that like for you? Unsurprisingly, their response is, it's normal. Mm. It's normal. It's what we expect. Mm. It's what we've learned to expect. It's what we live with. Well, of course, this is not normal. Mm. And it's chilling to think that our children are growing up here in New York City. You know, we had a man come in for an interview for a position, and he was doing very interesting research, and it was about working with young people using technology and media like text and so forth to get them to come for their therapy sessions. And I asked him what he thought about what was happening with children here in New York City, black and brown children with stop and frisk. And his response was, well, you know, it's bad. It should not be happening. And it is our reality. Well, that to me is problematic. I think that as practitioners and as scholars and researchers, we too have accepted this kind of behavior or this kind of reality as the way things are, and that's just the way it is. When in fact, these things are extremely harmful. It causes great harm to young people, because now what are those young men going to do who are now going to become fathers? Those young women, I mean, I have women in class who tell me, now that we're teaching the anti-oppression content, that we are, through this content, awakening areas that they have long suppressed. Mm. And the way they get through their lives is to keep that stuff buried deeply. Mm. So here we have people who are going to work with other human beings being inauthentic in who they are. Because to be fully who they are is to place them at risk.
So it sounds like a double-edged sword. You know, what are those untoward effects of the suppressing or the burying racism? If you acknowledge it, you
yes.
have to deal with the pain. If you suppress it, it comes out in other ways, perhaps
right.
through blood
yes,
pressure.
Yes.
And it perpetuates healthcare disparities. Before
yes.
we wrap up, I want to emphasize that hypertension kills. About 1,000 deaths per day are attributed to high blood pressure. It robs some people of their eyesight. It contributes to the alarmingly high rate of individuals who currently receive dialysis, and African Americans make up a large proportion of the patients on dialysis. High blood pressure is a health condition that affects 1 out of 3 Americans and disproportionately affects blacks. If you or someone you know has high blood pressure, consider how chronic stress could be impacting your ability to live a healthier life and what actions need to be taken to eliminate or manage chronic stress. Diana, is there anything else you want
to
share?
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left, actually, and I actually wanted to go back to that point that you just raised as well as add on to that, the idea of the double-edged sword, and I'm interested, Willie, in your thoughts about the issue of if you suppress, you're holding it in, it can blow up later, play out later. If you don't suppress it, you know, it's with you always. It's way too present and painful sometimes. What's your sense about that and what you do with that?
Where I am today on this, and I have arrived at this place after years of looking and understanding, because, again, what we're talking about is, for me, internalized racism,
mm-hmm.
which would have me say to myself, somehow I am responsible for mm-hmm. the fact that I am treated so badly in this country. Yesterday I was having a conversation with my cousin who is going to introduce me when I speak in my hometown of Apalachicola, Florida, for the 28th annual celebration of MLK. And he and I are the same age. We went through school together. And he was saying to me, you know, Willie, probably the best thing we can do for our children right now is to teach them that when they are stopped by police, they must be very cautious and very careful, that they have to keep their hands where the police can see them, that they must not get angry, that they must maintain a sense of composure and stay very calm. And I listened to that, and, you know, the week of December 16th, we had a protest here on our campus, and I listened to about 300 students in two different days talking about their upset around the Eric Garner and Mike Brown situations. And what they essentially said to me as one of these folks from the 60s is, you guys were accommodationists in the way you dealt with these issues. And your accommodating did not prepare this place for us to show up as full human beings. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to die anyway from this stuff, we may as well die struggling. Mm-hmm. So I think I hope it's not as bad as that. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that we older heads are still around, we must contribute something here, and I think the contribution that we can make is to create opportunities for people to heal from these traumas. So that is possible.
I'm sorry,
that
go
is
ahead.
Possible.
And what?
That is possible.
That
people
is
can
possible.
Heal from the trauma. It doesn't ever go away, but mm-hmm. they can heal from it so that it doesn't get suppressed, because when it is suppressed, it doesn't go away either. It simply goes into the next generation.
So that's really powerful, and it's my sense as a white woman that these conversations that are having, and the speaking out about the discrimination and the differential treatment by police of people of color is really a healthy thing. That's my sense of it. And it plays back to your sort of opening comments about having the conversations about these issues and not suppressing them. I have to share with you that there was several weeks ago a post by, and I'm not going to remember her name, there was an article in on Salon.com by an African-American young woman who was coming up to New York and was on a train, and she was about to do a teach-in around Ferguson. And she was on the train, had her earbuds in, listening to music, looking out the window. The train was a full train. She had an empty seat beside her, and she had her work bag sitting there with her laptop opened up, but just sitting in it. And she said, she was looking out the window, and she said, suddenly I see this white hand come in and grab my stuff and move my stuff. And she said, I turned around and saw this white man and said to him, don't touch my stuff. And he said, well, you need to listen to me when I talk to you. And she went on a riff that was so powerful about how a black man would never think of touching a white woman's bag and moving it. He would do whatever he had to get her attention. And indeed, while he might have spoken to this man might have spoken to this woman, he wasn't waving in front of her face, or he didn't tap her on the shoulder, what have you. And I posted this on Facebook, and with the message that I'd like my friends to read this to the very end and not just to push like, but rather read it. And I will tell you that I had almost no white friends commenting on it, only my friends who were African American or Latina. I had almost no likes from my white friends on this. And I was shocked and appalled and disappointed. So I, from the standpoint of white privilege and trying to also have conversations about people who are not of color, trying to have a deeper understanding of what people of color face in this country and the subtleties and the nuances that we don't even have a clue about, I see these conversations as enormously important to all of us. And I'm hoping they'll continue.
I would just like to add, Diana, I'm so happy that you shared that story. There is something, too, that I'm learning after 23 years of teaching in a school of social work where the majority of my students are white. And that is that our students come to us with a sense of history that is really, really limited. So they don't know the history of the United States of America and the appalling things that have occurred in creating this great democracy in terms of African Americans and Native Americans and Japanese people and what we've done to various groups of people in this country. And the other thing that I notice is that oppression hurts everybody. And when I ask my white students how have they been harmed by oppression, they can't name it. And that's something that I would really challenge white people to work on, is to understand how oppression hurts white people too.
Yeah. Well, powerful message. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yes.
So chronic stress undoubtedly plays a significant role in healthcare disparities, specifically high blood pressure. And before we wrap up, I want to also emphasize that we know hypertension kills. About 1,000 deaths per day are attributed to high blood pressure. It robs some of their eyesight, and it contributes to the alarmingly high rate of individuals who currently receive dialysis. High blood pressure is a health condition that affects 1 out of 3 Americans and disproportionately affects blacks. If you or someone you know has high blood pressure, consider how chronic stress could be impacting your ability to live a healthier life, and think about what Willie said about the actions that are needed to be taken to eliminate or manage chronic stress.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just want to thank you, Dr. Kenya Beard, for producing this segment of Health Styles, and to Dr. Willie Tolliver for coming on Health Styles today. This was a fascinating discussion, and I thank you both very much. I'm Diana
Thank
Mason.
Thank you for the opportunity, Diana.
I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.